This morning's scripture reading will be taken from the book of Hosea, chapter 12, verses 2 through 6. Hosea 12, 2 through 6. The Lord also brings a charge against Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. According to his deeds, he will recompense him. He took his brother by the heel in the womb, and in his strength he struggled with God. Yes, he struggled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought favor from him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spoke to us, that is, the Lord God of hosts. The Lord is his memorable name. So you, by the help of your God, return, observe mercy and justice, and wait on your God continually.
It's great to see everybody here this morning. To any visitors that we have in our midst, we want to encourage you to stick around and get to know us after our worship service. Please let us know any questions that you have about the way that we do things here or about the way that our congregation is organized scripturally. Or if you'd just like to sit down and have a Bible study and learn a little bit more about the Word of God, then we would love to sit down and do that with you. Please just let us know any spiritual needs that you have, and we'll do the very best we can to meet those needs. Many of the greatest stories involve change of some kind. Whether it's change on a grand scale in a culture or a society or a kingdom, or it's change in a single character. The term that's often applied to that, and I don't get to use my nerdy English major knowledge very often, is character arc. When you can see in a story from beginning to end the way that a character changes, that's his character arc or her character arc. Now, you see character arc in the Bible quite a bit, actually, because I think one of the things that God wants to convey through his word, most especially to fallen man, is you are capable of changing. You are capable of being something more than you were before you knew God. And that if you will live by God's will, there are amazing changes that can be made. You go from sinner to saint, from lost to saved. You see it in the life of Abraham, great changes in his life. Moses as well. It took a long time and wearing a lot of different hats for Moses to finally become the man that God needed him to be to lead Israel through the wilderness. Probably the greatest example of all is Saul of Tarsus, who changes so dramatically that people can't even believe it's the same man any longer. And he goes from being a persecutor of the church to an apostle of the church. The character that I want to look at this morning is found in the book of Genesis, all the way back in the book of Genesis. And his name, at least for part of his life, was Jacob. You might also know him as Israel. One of the other things that I really like from stories, and you see this in a lot of really great movies, is you know how when a movie will start at the end and then take you to a flashback and kind of show you how you got to that point? Where like a movie starts with the hero in dire straits. The hero is in some kind of desperate circumstances. You know, the cowboy is pinned down and there's bullets flying over his head. And you wonder, how did the character get to this point? And then the rest of the movie goes into a flashback and shows you how it is we got to that point. I'd like to do the same thing with Jacob this morning. And I want us to go, if you'd like to follow along here, go to Genesis chapter 32. And I want to read the end of our story and then go back and consider how it is that Jacob got to this point. So in Genesis chapter 32, Jacob is in a desperate circumstance. He's been gone from his family, that is to say his parents' household, for many years now. He's accumulated great wealth. He's a very rich man, has a lot of possessions, great flocks. He also has a large family, many children. And he's going home to see his brother Esau. Now, the last time that he heard about his brother Esau, his brother wanted to kill Jacob. He was enraged at him. And so he's desperate now. He doesn't know what's ahead of him. He sends all of his possessions on ahead of him. He sends his children and his family on ahead of him, hoping that this will represent a goodwill gesture toward his brother, hoping desperately that maybe wrath has left his brother's heart. And so now Jacob finds himself alone. He has nothing. Not a possession, not a family member, not a servant, no member of his household. He is alone on one side of the brook, anxious, scared. And a very strange thing happens to him. Begin in Genesis 32 and in verse 22. Now he arose that same night and took his two wives and his maids, his 11 children, and he crossed the ford of the Jabbok. And he took them and sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. And Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until daybreak. And when he saw that he had not prevailed against the man, he touched the socket of his thigh. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. So he said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." So in verse 28, the man said, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but you shall be called Israel. For you have striven with God and with men, and you have prevailed." But Jacob asked him and said in verse 29, "Please tell me your name now." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And so he blessed him there. And Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, "I've seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved." Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel, and he was limping on his leg. And I believe that from this time onward, Jacob is a changed man. You might even call wrestling in this with the angel or with the representative of God or even the personification of God, you might call this wrestling match his conversion story. And I don't think that it's a stretch or a misuse of the term within the context to call it his conversion story. Before this moment, Jacob was a certain kind of character. And we'll look at several main events from his life here with the rest of our lesson. But from this point on, something changes about Jacob. Even his name, literally, his name is changed by God from Jacob to Israel. His priorities change. His perspective on God changes. His attitude changes. Both in his heart and his behavior, Jacob is a very different person after he wrestles with God. Or again, an angel of God. And we'll talk about that near the end of our lesson. But how did we get to this point? How do we get to a point in this person's character arc where wrestling with God is the thing that provides the catalyst for such incredible change for him? Well, let's go all the way back to the beginning then. Because from the very beginning, we see Jacob and Esau as rivals. Rivals even in their mother's womb. Go back to Genesis chapter 25 and pick up and read here. And by the way, we're gonna do a lot of reading, but we're also going to do a lot of summarizing. Because if you're thinking that Ryan's going to try and say the entire life of Jacob in one lesson, you're right. So back in Genesis chapter, and the point is, I want to make it really clear from the beginning. The reason is, I don't want to stop and see a lot of details from Jacob's life, because you could take any one anecdote from his life and do an entire sermon on just one of the main events of his life. I want to see the character arc, though. I want to see the big picture of Jacob and see from point to point to point to the end the way that his life was kind of leading up to this moment and the sort of character that he was throughout. So we're going to hit these main events and try to see the big picture, and then we'll make a really great practical application there at the end. So in Genesis chapter 25, you'll notice here in verse 19, these are the records of the generations of Isaac. Isaac was Jacob and Esau's father. It goes on down that in verse 22, that the children who were in Rebekah's womb were struggling together within her. And she said, "If it is so, why am I this way?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." And I can't imagine that wasn't a disconcerting moment for Rebecca to hear that message. The older shall serve the younger, because that wasn't the way of things. It was the younger that served the older. It was the older sibling, the older son, that had the preeminent position within the children in a household. And so for her to hear this message, not only is there a physical discomfort, and I've never had twins in my body, so I can't say I understand it in a physical way, but from the physical discomfort of having two babies in your womb that clearly don't like each other very much, to the disconcerting nature of being told about kind of the character of their life, how their life was going to turn out, Rebecca must have been very disturbed by all of this. In verse 24, when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau, right? So he was a very red baby. Now it doesn't mean, when you look at the original language, it doesn't necessarily mean that this was a baby that was covered in red hair. It just means that he was red all over and he was a hairy baby. So he probably had like a really, really red tint to his skin. And some babies come out more red looking than other babies, just the color of their skin. And so he was a very, very red baby, but he was also noticeably kind of a hairy baby. So the first one comes out red and hairy, and they name him Esau. And the second one came out in verse 26, holding on to Esau's heel. I mean, that's how much of a rival Jacob was with his brother Esau, that as they're coming out of the womb, Jacob is literally holding on to Esau's heel as they're coming out of the womb. He was holding Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. And the name Jacob, if you have a little, like a little text at the bottom or a little footnote, the name Jacob means one who takes someone by the heel and supplants him. Like, you know, Sometimes in life, there's a thing called like a self-fulfilling prophecy. You ever heard that term, a self-fulfilling prophecy? When you find out that the older shall serve the younger, and you go, well, let's just go ahead and name the younger one who supplants, I suppose. All right. You're kind of setting them up then, aren't you, for a self-fulfilling prophecy. His name was Jacob. Now, Isaac was 60 years old when he gave birth to them. Now, when the boys grow up, we get to this story here, when the boys grow up. And you see the way that the rivalry continues to play out between them. The book of Genesis describes how different these two people were. You want to find two twins who are more different than them. I challenge you to find two twins that were more different than Jacob and Esau. Now Esau, he retains his red, hairy characteristics. He's a very, very burly, hairy man. And he loves the outdoors. He loves to hunt. Now, I know that seems like an incidental detail, but one thing, I don't want to read into it too much, but one thing to keep in mind about Esau is he was raised in a family of shepherds, which means they had no lack of food. Isaac, his father, was a very successful shepherd. They had plenty of livestock. So the fact that Esau is a hunter, maybe, I don't want to read too much into it, maybe tells you kind of something about his character. He had plenty of food at home, but he still feels the need to go out and kill something. He's restless. Esau is a restless man. He's a man of the woods, a man of the outside. He's a man who can't sit still for very long. Esau is a restless person that is not satisfied with the things that are at home. Esau is somebody who lacks perspective also, and you'll see that in the coming story at the end of this chapter. Esau is someone who is short-sighted. He doesn't see the big picture about things. Jacob, on the other hand, I'm not going to say that he's a real big picture kind of person, but you see the way that Jacob is described. He's described as a smooth man. That's how New American Standard puts it. He's a smooth man. I don't know exactly what that must mean, if that just means that he shaved, or I don't know if he didn't have a lot of muscle tone or something. I'm partial to the smooth, right? Maybe I'm not much of an Esau, but I'm probably more like a Jacob than anything else. But he's a smooth man who liked to stay at home. And his mother preferred him. Rebecca preferred him, whereas Jacob preferred Esau. And that preferential treatment, I think, sets them up for failure. Parents, good practical application. Even if you do prefer one child over the other, and I'm not saying it's right to do that, but even if you do, Never tell them. Never make it obvious. Isaac and Rebekah made it very clear who they preferred. Isaac preferred Esau, and he told him that. He made sure Jacob knew. He made sure Rebekah knew. He liked Esau's lifestyle. He liked the way that Esau caught game and would cook a savory dish for him. He just preferred Esau and always made that clear. And Rebekah always made it clear that she preferred Jacob. And when you show that preferential treatment, don't be surprised when sibling rivalry rears its ugly head. So as we get to the rest of the chapter here, we're going to talk about some red stuff. Esau goes out hunting, and who knows how long he was out, maybe a day, maybe 3 days, I don't know. It doesn't really say exactly how long he was out hunting, but he comes home from a hunt famished, and there's Jacob in the kitchen preparing a bowl of red soup. He's got a kettle of red soup, and Esau just kind of in his blunt manner says, "I'm starving to death here, why don't you get me a bowl of that red stuff there?" You like it, the irony there? His skin tone is very red. His hair is red. He's got a bowl of red stuff that he really wants. They call him Edom, and Edom means red, right? His nickname becomes Red. He's not a trucker, by the way, like Old Red. Oh, there's Old Red down there. He's not like a trucker or something. They call him Red because he's red. He's red all over, and he likes his red soup, and I can't imagine that he didn't have blood stains on his clothes and probably blood under his fingernails from the hunting that he did. And, you know, he's out field dressing game. I mean, he probably had blood stains all over his clothes as well. So they just call him Red. There's Old Red coming down the road. So he asked for a bowl of that red stuff. And Jacob, seeing an opportunity, says, "I'll tell you what, I'll cut you a deal." Jacob's always good with the deals. Wheeling in the dealing. He says, "I'll cut you a deal. I'll get you a bowl of my red soup if you give me your birthright." My birthright? You mean like my inheritance? Like, you mean everything that comes along with being the firstborn son and all the privileges and advantages that come along with that? You mean my birthright for a bowl of red soup? Is that really what you're saying? Okay. It's a deal. And I think Esau's justification must be along the lines of, "I'm starving to death, and if my choice is starving to death with a birthright or having a bowl of soup, and I guess I give up my birthright, but at least I don't starve, all right." And it just shows the short-sighted nature of Esau. And by the way, I don't want to get too deep here because this is a whole sermon on its own, but one little thing here. In Romans chapter 9, the Apostle Paul quotes from Malachi 1. And there's a passage there that says, "Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated." Now, that doesn't mean that God hated him in some kind of moral sense or that he decided to hate him in advance. But God could always see a difference between Jacob and Esau in their character. Jacob and Esau showed by the way they lived and the way they behaved which one of them was going to continue the line of Abraham and Isaac toward the Messiah. I don't think God could trust Esau. God needed somebody to continue that line because he made a promise to Abraham that one of your descendants, your seed, will bless the entire world. And that's a messianic prophecy. And if you've got two sons, one of them is going to continue the messianic line. One of them is going to pick up the blessing given to Abraham and continue to walk with it. You can either pick the really short-sighted one who'd sell his birthright for a bowl of soup, or you're going to pick the other one. And God picked the one that he could trust. Now, at this point, Jacob's not like a holy and righteous man, but at least God knew, I can trust him at least with this small task of continuing the messianic line. And he couldn't trust Esau with that because Esau sells his birthright for just about nothing. God judges us based on who we actually are. Not potential or I wish I had done this or I could have been captain of... God doesn't judge us based on that. He says, "How are you living? What are you doing? Show me by your behavior." And that's how God's going to judge us. And in the end, Esau walks away all bitter and hurt because he sold his birthright for a bowl of soup. And I don't know, maybe it was the best bowl of soup he's ever had in his life. I sure hope it was. But we skip on a few years in their lives. And we find the blessing in disguise. Now, to play on words, I'm not talking about the blessing that's in disguise. I mean the blessing that was procured while in disguise. When their father Isaac is very old, he knows that he's on his way out. He can sense in his body that he's reaching the end of his life. And he calls for his eldest son Esau. And he asks Esau to go catch game for him and make a savory dish. You know, the way that I always liked Esau. You know, the way I always enjoyed a savory dish. Would you go out and hunt game for me and prepare one of those savory dishes? And when you get home, I'll give you a blessing because I know I'm dying and it's time for me to start wrapping things up in life. So Esau goes out and he starts to hunt. But lo and behold, who's been eavesdropping on the other side of the tent wall? But Rebekah, their mother. She goes to her preferred son, Jacob, and says, I overheard your father telling Esau that if he prepares a savory dish for him, he'll give him a blessing. Now, I think they all knew what the blessing was, by the way. They knew what the blessing was. It was the blessing given to Abraham, that your descendants will be as numerous as the sand of the seashore and the stars of the heavens, and all the earth will be blessed through your descendants. And you'll come and possess the land of Canaan. They knew what the blessing was. And boy, that blessing was worth a whole lot more than just a birthright. A birthright was just possessions and sheep and that sort of thing. But this blessing, now that blessing was something special. So Rebekah tells her preferred son Jacob, why don't you go kill two goats and you prepare a savory dish the way that Esau does? Because you're a good cook. You can probably replicate whatever it is that Esau slaps together. And I want you to prepare this savory dish. And I want you to go to your father and give it to him. And you get the blessing. Well, hold on, Mom. I'm smooth all over. I'm not like my brother Esau. What if Dad grabs my arm or feels the back of my neck and knows that I'm not Esau? Then I'm going to be in a real bad spot because not only am I going to not get the blessing, but he'll know that I'm a deceiver. He'll know I'm a deceiver. Okay, well, don't worry, Jacob. What you'll do is you'll take the skin from the goats that you kill and you're going to wrap the skin around your arms and around the back of your neck. And don't worry, your dad's practically gone blind, so he's not going to know either way based on a visual inspection. Your dad's practically blind, but if you put the goat skin, right, you'll have the goat hair on your arm and the goat hair on your neck and you'll be able to like feel like him. And don't forget to put on Esau's shirt so that you smell like Esau too. So they prepare all of that. They do all that. Knock, knock, knock on the tent door because you can knock on a tent door, apparently. Father, I've brought you the savory dish that you like oh so much. Who is that that I hear? Identify yourself. Well, I'm Esau. I'm Esau, your son. I brought you your dish. Yeah, but it sounds like the voice of Jacob. Well, Dad, just eat. Son, come here. Come here, son. And Isaac puts his hand on the back of his neck and on his arm, and he feels, and he says, it's such a strange thing. I hear the voice of my son Jacob, but I feel him hairy all over like my son Esau. And when I bring him in close for a hug, he certainly smells like Esau. All right. So he eats the dish and he proceeds to bless him in verse 27. See, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Verse 28. Now may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, and an abundance of grain and new wine. May people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over your family, your brothers and your mother's sons. May they bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you, and blessed be those who bless you. So Jacob leaves. And then comes Esau with his savory dish. Father, I've prepared you the savory dish just like you asked. Now bless me. And I like the way New American Standard describes it. It says that Isaac trembled violently in verse 3. He trembled violently and said, well, then who was it who brought me this savory dish? Now, Esau knows exactly who it is. It's Jacob. Jacob, my brother, he's deceived me these 2 times. He tricked me and got my birthright. And now he's tricked me again and gotten my blessing. As soon as our father is dead and I've grieved for him, I'm killing my brother Jacob. So Rebekah, their mother, senses the tension and asks Isaac, why don't we send Jacob away so that he can go find a wife from among our kinsmen and not from among the Canaanites? Really, what she wants is to save Jacob's life, and Isaac sees it as a good idea and sends him away. Now, let's open up our Bibles now and see a different side of this story, okay? A different part of this story here. Jacob leaves, knowing that his brother hates him, knowing that his brother wants to kill him. And in chapter 28, we see a rather strange event. In chapter 28, down in verse 10, Jacob departed from Beersheba and went down to Haran, and he came to a certain place and spent the night there because the sun had already set. He took one of the stones of that place and put it under his head and lay down in that place. And he had a dream. Behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. Your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth. You'll spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you. I'll keep you wherever you go. I'll bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Now Jacob takes the rock that was under his head and he sets it up. And he pours oil over it as some kind of libation to the Lord. Then he proceeds to make a rather interesting statement. And I'll say this, it's a very telling statement. Very telling of the point that Jacob is still at in his life. He arose early the morning, he set up the stone, he poured oil over it in verse 18. He called the name of that place Bethel, which is the house of God. Verse 20, then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. Now, I know different commentaries kind of take a different take on this. Some people are a little bit more forgiving of Jacob than probably I am. But I think within the context of his character arc, from where he is as a person, he's trying to wheel and deal still. He's been wheeling and dealing his whole life. Because his brother Esau could always best him in physical strength. But something that Jacob could always do better was cleverness. He was always crafty. He was always cunning. He was always clever. He always knew how to make the deal. If God does everything that he promises, then he will be my God. Only then. Does God have to make promises more than one time? Does God really have to show us evidence? Was not the vision evidence enough? Was not the promise to Abraham evidence enough? Was not the promise to Isaac evidence enough? You know, Jacob needs to realize his father was a miraculous child. That Sarah could not conceive children until God miraculously gave her that ability. His father's very existence was confirmation of the promises of God. But he's not really going to be my God. Until I see all of this stuff done, until God actually does take care of me and he keeps me safe and he brings me back and gives me all the stuff that he promised me, then and only then will he be my God. Which stands in stark contrast to somebody like Abraham. Remember in Hebrews chapter 11, it describes these great men and women of faith. In the book of Hebrews chapter 11, it describes Abraham as someone who was willing to do what God asked him to do, to go out into the mysterious beyond without really knowing exactly how things were going to end. Abraham was seeking a country that was not built by human hands. He was seeking a land that was not of an earthly nature, but a heavenly one. And Abraham never saw the fulfillment of his promises except at a great distance. And that is why it was reckoned unto Abraham as faith. Because when God said, walk that way, Abraham said, all right. And when God said, go over there, Abraham said, all right. And when God said, you're going to have a child this time next year, while Sarah was over here laughing, Abraham said, okay. And Hebrews 11 says he didn't get to see the fulfillment of all those promises in person. But he believed in God. And he was willing to strike out into the unknown because God told him to. That's very different from Jacob here. So Jacob goes to the land of his forefathers, to his kinsmen, and he finally meets his match. He meets his match in his uncle Laban. Now Laban was portrayed, he's already been portrayed as kind of a scoundrel of sorts. He's always also about the wheeling and the dealing and getting the best deal. Because you saw that back when Isaac came to marry Rebekah, right? Or when at least Abraham's servant came to find a wife for Isaac. It wasn't their father. It wasn't Rebekah and Laban's father kind of doing the dealing. It was Laban. Laban was the one making the deals there. Laban is someone, he knows how to get the best deal out of people. Kind of a swindler, kind of a shyster, a bit of a scoundrel. So he's so happy to have Jacob come. Well, Jacob, I just happen to have two daughters over here. You've met one of them already, Rachel. She's beautiful. And if you work 7 years for me, I'll let you marry Rachel. Now, Jacob worked those 7 years, and the text says that they were just like almost no time to him because he loved Rachel so much that the 7 years just flew by. And it comes time for the wedding. And they get married. And the marriage is consummated. And then they wake up the next morning. Jacob married the sister, Leah. And in one of the great twists of irony in the entire Bible, Laban says, well, it's not our custom for the younger to marry before the older. Did that one sting a little bit, Jacob? You mean the younger brother versus the younger or the older brother? Did that? I wonder if that stung a little bit there. 7 years of working for Rachel, and he has been hoodwinked the same way that he hoodwinked his brother. Well, that's not very fair. Well, it is what it is. You married her. You should have lifted the veil earlier, buddy. So Laban says, I'll tell you what, I'll cut you a deal, okay? I'll cut you a deal. You can marry Rachel also. We'll do kind of a two-for-one deal, but you got to work another 7 years. All right. Now, of course, the text does say he allows him to marry Rachel, and then he kind of works the 7 years after that, right? So he doesn't have to work another 7 years before he can marry Rachel. He marries her, and then he works another 7 years after that. But then, I mean, the story keeps going and going and going. As we go on, Jacob ends up making Laban very, very rich. Because remember, God said, I'm going to bless you wherever you go. So everything Jacob did, he found success. He became a breeder with the flocks that Laban owned. And the flocks grew and they grew and they grew and they grew. And it gets to this point where the flocks are so big, right? Jacob comes to his father-in-law / uncle Laban and says, listen, I've become a rich man. You've become a rich man. There's not room for all of us. Let me take all my stuff and get out of here. Well, but Laban sees the cash cow walking out the door, and he begs him, well, why don't you just stay a little bit longer? Please, just stay a little bit longer. So he stays a little bit longer, and eventually he gets to this point where all of Laban's servants are getting angry with Jacob. because Jacob's flock is getting so big, and it looks as if by comparison, Laban's becoming a poor man. And they're sick and tired of the way that all of Jacob's sheep keep breeding, and all of Laban's sheep aren't breeding. All the striped and spotted and speckled sheep are outnumbering all the black and white sheep. And they're so furious with him that Jacob knows it's time to get out of there. So he gathers his family together, and they try to head out. He finds himself stuck in the middle. That's one thing you see about the life of Jacob. In multiple occasions, he's a man who, because of his conniving nature, often finds himself in the middle of things. Because he's always looking out for the deal. He's always looking out for number one, right? He's always looking out for himself. He lies. He cuts deals. He's wheeling and dealing. And he always finds himself in the middle. He found himself in the middle with his wives. It'd be funny if it wasn't true. The two sisters go from being sisters to baby rivals. And Leah has a bunch of babies, and Rachel gets mad, so she takes one of her handmaids and says, "Here, make babies with her." And so she starts having babies, and Leah gets her handmaid and says, "Here, have babies with her." And then finally Rachel starts having babies. And then they start selling Jacob for who gets to have Jacob that night. "Oh, you got some mandrakes over there? I'll tell you what, I'll give you my mandrakes if I get to have Jacob tonight. Jacob, come on over here. I bought you for the evening." And everybody's having babies, and there's just Jacob in the middle of it all. Jacob in the middle between Laban and his daughters. Jacob in the middle between his servants and Laban's servants. Jacob in the middle. He's always getting himself in the middle. Good practical application to keep in mind is, when you don't live an honest life, you start to create conflict where conflict didn't need to exist. Where frustration didn't need to exist. Relationships get destroyed. Friendships get ruined. And finally, he's allowed to leave by Laban. And it's not a clean break, by the way. It's not a clean break. They leave in the middle of the night, and Laban gets furious with Jacob because you're gonna leave without letting me say goodbye to my grandchildren? Without letting me say goodbye to my own daughters? What do you think of me? I think Jacob knows exactly what he thinks of Laban. Which brings us all the way back to the beginning. Jacob has made a break from Laban. He's left Laban. He's a very rich man. He's got 11 children, 2 wives, and 2 concubines in tow, and more sheep than any of us could probably ever imagine. And yet, in the middle of that night, when he is finally alone. And it's not about his dad, it's not about his mom, it's not about his brother, it's not about his wives, it's not about children or his uncle or money or possessions or blessings and birthrights. And finally, when everything else is whittled away and Jacob has to stare up into the stars and face God, that he realizes what kind of a man he's been this whole time. And so God comes in the form of a man to wrestle him. And he wrestles him throughout the entire night until daybreak. Now that doesn't mean that Jacob is a really good wrestler. What it means is that God was willing to hold back. Because with a single touch, God was able to dislocate Jacob's leg. With a single touch, he could dislocate his leg. At any moment, if God had wanted to, he could have killed Jacob. So why does he wrestle with him? What's the point of this story? Why does Jacob get all the way here? Well, it goes back to our scripture reading from Hosea chapter 12. In Hosea 12 verses 2 through 6, it describes Jacob as being one who wrestles with man and wrestles with God. And everywhere he goes, he's in conflict. He's always pushing and pushing and pushing. And he never found favor with God until he finally started to weep before God and beg for his favor. He finally found favor when he wept, when he humbled himself, when he realized he couldn't wheel and deal his way out of this any longer. He couldn't will himself to success. He needed God. You need God as well. I need God. All the money in the world and all the possessions in the world and all the accolades and achievements and awards in the entire world mean nothing until you finally start wrestling with God and figuring things out. And it's okay to wrestle with God. He literally wrestled with God, but we're allowed to wrestle with God. We're allowed to ask tough questions of God. We're allowed to have a vigorous and robust prayer life. We're allowed to wrestle with God and figure things out. And at the end of it, once we've wrestled with God and survived, as we all will, we walk away being people who are refined and changed by that experience. And he goes from being Jacob, one who supplants, to being Israel, one who's willing to wrestle with God, but survive. We're going to go and offer a prayer at this time, and then we'll disperse to our classes. And as a reminder, adults, if you could leave the auditorium as quickly as possible so that we're not disruptive to the kids during their Bible drill. Let's go ahead and have a prayer at this time. Thank you so much, God, for all of your many blessings. We love you so very much. We love the example of Jacob and Esau, of their families. We love the examples, not just of the great things they did, but also of the foolish things that they did, because it's in those mistakes, it's in their sins that we tend to learn a lot more. God, we see ourselves in the example of Jacob. We see the way that we have at times been stubborn and self-willed, where we've wanted to make our own way in life, and we have not consented to your will. We've not relented. We have not given ourselves fully over to you. God, it's your will and not ours that needs to be done. And help us this day to make a resolution to do that better. Help us to love you always in everything that we do, to love you during our Bible classes and to appreciate the word and make good application. Help us to love each other as brothers and sisters ought to love each other. And in your Son's most holy and blessed name we pray. Amen.